Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrypt podcast. So the Twitter world is abuzz with the Fellow trial, a RCT on apneic oxygenation in the ICU. Let's hear from the lead author. All right, why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
So my name is Matt Semler, and I'm a critical care fellow at Vanderbilt.
Excellent. And the reason we're speaking with you today is because of the Fellow trial. What was the Fellow trial?
So the Fellow trial is a study that we recently did here, which randomized patients being intubated in the medical intensive care unit to either usual care, in which they didn't have any oxygen, supplemental oxygen during laryngoscopy, or apneic oxygenation, where they got 15 liters per minute of 100% oxygen by high-flow nasal cannula from before induction till after completion of the procedure.
And kudos to you on getting this trial done. This is really a ton of work, and it's really impressive.
Yeah, well, it was a team effort here. We had a lot of people involved, and we're really excited to have gotten to the end of it.
The first question I have, and most of these questions come from our friends on Twitter in the emergency medicine and critical care world.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to credit who asked the question, but I may forget, in which case I apologize to the people who made the original queries. But the first one, and I think it's a great question, was what was your stance on apneic oxygenation before starting the trial?
Pre-test, right? So I think that's a great question when you're interpreting trials. My wife's emergency medicine, I'm critical care. Our group here at Vanderbilt, the emergency medicine group, has been very big into apneic oxygenation. And so through them, I got very interested in this and was using it prior to the onset of the trial, but was one of the few people in critical care here using it. And so I think our group is a group of people who are used to doing clinical trials in sepsis and ARDS. This is our first airway management trial, but I think, so we have a pretty reasonable amount of equipoise. So I was using it personally, but I don't think it was an environment in which everyone was using it.
And now this was a pragmatic trial. We here at MCrit love pragmatic trials, but it does lead to some questions. The primary outcome of the trial was the nadir oxygen saturation, and you guys very wisely included an extension into the time after the patient actually had the tube placed to account for pulse ox lag. But Rob Bryant asks, was there any consideration to actually looking at the time until desaturation, which probably would be more representative of apox's benefits because it doesn't prevent a patient from desaturating. They all eventually will. It's how long it takes to get there.
Yeah, and a lot of the prior literature in the operating room, that was the measure, right, duration of apnea without desaturation, that continuous measure of time until a fixed 95% or 90%. I think for the clinician, I'm not sure which of those two is more clinically meaningful. I think because the negative consequences of hypoxemia seemed probably to be more linked to the lowest value. That was why we chose that. That's been what's done in prior studies, that the 2006 Blue Journal paper on non-invasive ventilation for pre-oxygenation, which is one of the kind of foundational studies that did show a benefit in airway management, used this as their primary outcome. And there have been a number of other studies. We do provide information about that in the online supplement. There's a figure which shows the interaction between the duration of intubation and when and desaturation, because obviously those two are linked. But the other, you know, if a patient was intubated and was able to be intubated without ever desaturating, that's an important thing too, and you don't capture that in the time to desaturation.
In the supplement, you guys outlined very nicely the way airway was managed in the unit for both groups. But what was not there was a regimented procedure for apneic oxygenation itself. I was wondering if there was one. For instance, the nasal cannula was placed at the 15 liters in the intervention group, but there was no discussion on how airway was maintained, what was actually going on during that apneic period in either of the groups. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, and so I think the delivery of the intervention in the apneic oxygenation group, these patients received 15 liters high flow, 100% oxygen through the Comfort Soft Plus Westmed, which is just what our ICU has. But it was a high flow nasal cannula, so it wasn't a standard nasal cannula. It was humidified in the vast majority of the cases. That was placed prior to the induction meds being pushed and kept in place until after the end of the procedure. And in the apneic oxygenation, or in the usual care group, patients got pre-oxygenation. They, you know, had all of the same usual care interventions, but didn't have any oxygen flow during laryngoscopy. Kind of ancillary things that were occurring. You know, obviously people think about keeping, maintaining airway patency during apneic oxygenation. So this is a third of these patients were on BiPAP for their pre-oxygenation and even after induction. And so in that group, we know, because we have delivered and returned tidal volumes, that the airway would patent. Assessing airway patency is a little trickier in the rest. This is a sick group. These patients, so 40% or so of these patients had an oral airway in and a head tilt chin lift maneuver. And so they were at least receiving some attempts to open the airway. It's hard to assess whether those were successful or not. I think those are the two key things that I can think of. We detailed the patient position and other things that may go into this, and body mass index and some of those things that may affect the patency of the airway and ability to deliver apneic oxygenation. But, you know, I think we were very rigorous in trying to make sure that patients got the oxygen delivered and were successful in that. I at least made an effort to making sure the airway was patent within this scope of, you know, emergent practice, I think, did what we could. We also looked at those subgroups. So those who we knew the airway was patent because they were returning volumes on BiPAP, it wasn't like there was a benefit in that group where we could document the airway patency.
Well, so this is where it gets interesting, and these are the exact questions that I'm so happy we're able to get some clarification on.
Yeah.
So BiPAP in the standard group would obviate any benefits of apneic oxygenation when comparing to those patients.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you start thinking about this in detail, so there's the period before the induction meds are pushed, pre-oxygenation. There's the period between induction and the introduction of the laryngoscope. And then there's the period between the laryngoscope and placement of the endotracheal tube. And I think it's something that's a really good point, that so pre-oxygenation is the same in both groups functionally for this study, right?
Sure.
The biggest difference emerges once the laryngoscope blade is placed, right? Because in that context, the apneic oxygenation group is getting 15 liters, you know, continuously. The usual care group is getting nothing, right? And there's a variable amount of difference in that middle time between drugs being pushed and the blade being in place when, in, you know, for some patients who are on BiPAP, the added flow of the 15 liters may not be that much. For some patients who are on just nasal cannula or a face mask, there may be a bigger difference. Certainly the biggest difference is once the laryngoscope is in place.
Sure. So let's deal with the standard group just for a sec. So we believe, and did you guys subset this out by the interventions in the standard group and the APOX group for things like BiPAP, or do we just have the mean of the entire cohort when you say a third?
No, we looked at the intervention and the primary outcome in a series of subgroups, including those on BiPAP.
Okay, so then we could guess then probably a third of the patients in the standard group were on BiPAP. In the patients remaining, in the two-thirds, how many of them were being bagged during the period after induction until laryngoscopy?
Yeah, it's a lot. This is a pretty sick group overall. And so if I'm remembering right, I think 40% of all patients received bag valve mask ventilation. That's in the supplement. I can pull it up here. But it's a large number.
And so that's really the other key group in that standard cohort that potentially would not have a benefit to apneic oxygenation, because as you very astutely pointed out, during the period between induction and laryngoscopy, because there still would be a benefit ostensibly while they had the blade in, because they weren't being bagged. So
yeah, and I think you make the point in your review article from 2012 in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, I think, about the relative efficacy of having a continuous flow of nasal cannula during apnea as opposed to a non-rebreather or even bag valve mask or even BiPAP. So I think that's an important question. How much is actually being delivered during that period between induction and laryngoscopy? I think it's really difficult to get at with each of those possible interventions. But you're exactly right. I think this is not a group who was being paralyzed and then having a long period where nothing was happening, you know, like happens in the OR and a lot of those studies. That may be part of the difference in findings.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
Was there a mandatory wait time that was enforced between the induction meds being pushed and the first attempt at laryngoscopy, or was this pretty much just when it felt right?
Yeah, so this a lot of these patients got rocuronium and so had a little bit longer wait time than those maybe who got sucks, but there was no, the only aspect of the procedure that was controlled was the apneic oxygenation intervention. I can tell you that the vast majority that we report that duration, and it's not that dissimilar from prior studies, that it's in a range of a little bit more than 1 minute, less than 3 minutes, and kind of in that 2 minute range. There was I know that there's no minimum time because one of the patients, an IV pump exploded as the induction meds were being pushed, and they got intubated in 17 seconds from drugs in to tube in. So that's our shortest, but the majority of them were kind of in a normal range.
Perfect. Was there any note of the patients in the AppOx group who actually continued to have CPAP maintained or BiPAP maintained during their apneic oxygenation?
So what proportion of them, so there were all of them who were on BiPAP before were continued on BiPAP until the laryngoscope was introduced. And so now what that's delivering, again, is hard to be able to quantify, but that was, you know, that 30% or so of patients who, and I have the number here, so it was almost 40% of patients. No, 30% of patients who are on BiPAP before for pre-oxygenation were continued on that until laryngoscopy.
Was there, and I might have missed it in the supplement, was there note of this oxygen saturation just prior to the time of induction in the supplement?
Yeah, that's an incredibly important question. So in the 6 hours prior, these patients, about half of them had a sat below 90%, and their average amount of oxygen they were requiring was 40% FiO2. This group did a pretty good job pre-oxygenating, and so the saturation at the time of induction was 98% in the usual care arm and 99% in the apneic oxygenation arm. So despite having reasonable FiO2 requirements and a lot of hypoxic respiratory failure, the group did a good job pre-oxygenating these patients before induction.
Absolutely. That was fantastic. And I don't know if you could answer this right now, Matt, which is fine. And if you are able to answer in the future and you email me, I'd very much appreciate it. But I think the question people are asking is, what percentage of the patients in the standard care group really were just left alone during the period between induction and laryngoscopy, meaning they weren't on BiPAP, they weren't being bagged, they were just sitting there very comparably to the OR studies that showed efficacy in the past?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in Table 1, we give the pre-oxygenation, and so I can say that about 40% were being bagged at the time. About a third of them were on BiPAP, and there's some overlap for people who move from BiPAP to being bagged, that sort of thing. And then in the supplement, we provide those who required additional ventilation between induction and laryngoscopy. And the numbers are fairly comparable. So it's only probably a third of these patients who didn't get bagged or BiPAP at some point.
Now, in your conclusions, you took the stance that until there's further studies in this particular group, meaning critically ill patients or particularly critically ill patients in the ICU, we probably should not be using apneic oxygenation. Is that your personal belief as well, or is that the conglomeration of the study authors and the institution?
Yeah. So I was using it before the study, and I'm not now. And the reasoning for that, I think this the argument to use it would be it's safe, right? Our study shows it's safe. And, you know, so it's not hurting them. Could it be helping? I think what's dissuaded me is there's just a lot else to do during that time period. And I think, you know, our ongoing focus in this research has been, you know, identifying things that work and just doing the things that we know already work consistently. And so I think adding one more thing into that hectic mix, it would have to be something that I'm convinced is effective to continue doing it. So I think I would love to see further study of this, and particularly I think this was the first study outside of the operating room. It's a hugely different population, but it's who we see, right? This is every patient in our ICU. We tried to enroll in this study. So, you know, it's very applicable to our environment, and I think most ICUs and probably a lot of EDs maybe more applicable than the, you know, patients who had just normal lungs being intubated in the operating room. So I think one of my take-home points from this is that these are patients who are failing BiPAP, failing non-rebreathers. It's not, I guess, maybe surprising that a little bit more oxygen wouldn't help these people, whereas it might in the OR, or if you're intubating someone for stroke or trauma where the pulmonary function is preserved. You know, so I am not using it in my practice in these our critically ill patients because, you know, they're largely hypoxemic and it didn't seem to have any signal in that group. But I think it doesn't rule out further study or even maybe use in populations that are different than this population.
Fair enough. You know, I've said from the beginning that ATBOX does not work in patients with shunt physiology unless there's a maintenance of their recruitment that you achieve during preox. And I think this study definitely bears that out in my mind. Yeah. As to the further conclusions of whether it has any utility, I think there's now equipoise on that matter. But you've certainly proven that we can't directly extrapolate operating room data to the environment of the critically ill patient.
Yeah, I think that's been a challenge of airway management research for those of us who aren't anesthesiologists. And I think it's something that the nice part, what I like about this study, I wish the results had been different. Obviously, I was somebody using this. But I think it shows that we do need to study this and study it with the same rigor that you would take to sepsis or ARDS. And so I think that's our hope, is that the next one of these studies, that, you know, fairly large, maybe even multi-center trials of these things that we're talking about and focused on will be positive.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time talking to me, Matt.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate it.
Well, there you go. Now, what can we say about apneic oxygenation after this trial? Well, a few very important points came up. This was a pragmatic trial, meaning nothing was controlled except the absolutely necessary parts of the intervention. But even in a pragmatic trial, you need the intervention itself to be performed in a way that allows it to actually work. For instance, if in CRASH 2, another pragmatic trial, they just mismixed the TXA, then that would not be an adequate testing. So the question is, in the fellow trial, was apneic oxygenation given its fair test? Well, in order for apneic oxygenation to be evaluated, what you would want ideally is apnea in both groups, and then the provision of high-flow O2 to the glottis in the intervention group. So why don't we deal with the first part about apnea? So a majority of the patients in the control arm of this study were not left apneic during the period between induction and laryngoscopy. And my presumption, I didn't get to ask Matt about it, is if there was a failed laryngoscopy, I don't think those patients were left apneic either. They were probably either put back on their BiPAP or more likely bagged. And I imagine even the patients between induction and laryngoscopy who weren't bagged probably were bagged post-failed laryngoscopy. And so these patients weren't apneic except in a small percentage. From what we were basically able to derive, maybe around 30% of the patients in the control arm were left apneic. And this is, in my mind, the group that really is the test of apneic oxygenation. The patients you don't want to bag, you don't want to put on positive pressure, and so you leave them alone during that post-medication period until laryngoscopy. And that's where ATBOX, I think, is providing the most benefit, those 45 to 60 seconds. But these patients in the control arm received either BVM ventilation or BiPAP, not just CPAP, but BiPAP, meaning that they were actually getting breaths pushed in during their apneic period. So to my mind, only about a third of the patients were actually being tested. Now, Matt's point, and his absolutely true point, is that ATBOX still might have shown benefit in those patients at the period the laryngoscope is actually in the mouth. And that may be true. but we didn't evaluate true apnea in a bunch of the control patients. When we look at the other side of the equation, was apneic oxygenation adequately provided? Well, in order to do that, you need the nasal cannula, which all these patients had, and then you need an open glottis in order to actually make sure that the gas at the nose gets down into the lungs. Now, we don't have exact numbers on how many patients had a patent airway. We do know that oral airways and head tilt chin lift was applied to approximately 40% of the patients. In the other 60%, I'm not sure how we guaranteed the airway patency. Matt's points to the effect of some of these patients who are on BiPAP don't necessarily do it for me. That's not maintaining airway patency except when they're actually getting the breaths. And I'm not sure whether that really does it or not. It makes me feel better that, yes, when there was a provision of positive pressure, they did get return. That doesn't really do it for me on the question of was it paid in between, but it really doesn't matter because we should just throw out all of the BiPAP patients in both groups because there's no reason to think apneic oxygenation is going to benefit the BiPAP players except during the laryngoscopy itself. So what are we left with? In standard ICU practice, where at least in the Vanderbilt ICU, and I think in most ICUs, the patient is getting either bagged or positive pressure during the apneic period. Apneic oxygenation did not show a benefit that was statistically significant, though, and I always try to avoid any trend casting, but the trends were interesting if you take a look. But be that as it may, the primary outcome was not achieved. So if you are going to provide BiPAP or BVM ventilation during the apneic period, at this stage of the game, we're not sure if apneic oxygenation is providing benefit, and this study would show that it potentially does not. Now, I guess the real question you want to know is, will I keep using it in my ED critical care patients? I think Matt's point was the one to take, which is, if it's not providing benefit but doesn't cause harm, should we do it? Well, his take was that it's another step that's not necessarily providing benefit. My take is, forget about apneic oxygenation. Nasal cannula provides better pre-oxygenation in every method I use for pre-oxygenation. I'm going to continue doing it during pre-ox and therefore continue doing it during apox, especially because I don't bag my patients during the apneic period and I don't provide BiPAP during the apneic period. My patients are truly apneic. I'm going to avoid, if I can in any way possible, avoid bagging or providing positive pressure breaths to these patients. And therefore, I think my airway management is very close to the operating room experience, where apneic oxygenation has definitively shown a prolongation until desaturation. If you, like my friend Rich Levitan, like providing a few small breaths during the apneic period, there's pretty good reason to believe right now in patients with shunt physiology, apneic oxygenation may not provide you additional benefit. That just having the nasal cannula on while the laryngoscope is in the mouth, if you're going to be bagging or BiPAPing beforehand and probably after you fail an attempt at laryngoscopy, if you think that is a good way to go, apneic oxygenation may not provide additional benefit. I will say one more thing. If you believe in apneic CPAP, which I definitively do for my patients with shunt, it does not work unless you have a nasal cannula or you switch from CPAP to BiPAP. In both settings, you are giving flow to continue the provision of that CPAP. So if you want apneic CPAP, then you neither need apneic oxygenation with the nasal cannula or BiPAP provision. My friend Josh Farkas has an excellent post on why he likes BiPAP during the apneic period. You could check that out. I will link to it in the show notes. I would like to congratulate and commend Dr. Semler and his colleagues who performed this trial. It was amazing. Well done, folks. All right. I would love to hear what you thought about the fellow trial, what you're going to do with your practice. The best place to put that is in the comments at mcrit.org/158. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.